You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
Hi there, and welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I am Jen Zaman, and I am in for Judy Ansel, who was out on assignment this week. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Pipefitters Local 533 and Sheet Metal Workers Local 2. The Pipefitter powers the engines of industry that keep business thriving in America. They install, maintain, and service any system that involves air conditioning, heating, chemicals, or refrigeration in residential, commercial, or industrial buildings, as well as high-tech clean rooms. Sheet Metal Workers Local 2 represents 1,200 members in western Missouri and eastern Kansas. We start with the sheet metal and make nearly anything out of it for industry, heating and air conditioning, architectural roofs and siding, kitchens, and even works of art. And we thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, Peter Fleming, author of The Mythology of Work, How Capitalism Persists Despite Itself, says work used to be inextricably linked to survival and self-preservation. Now it has morphed into a painful and meaningless ritual, colonizing almost every part of our lives. Then, we focus on some of the earliest victims of the U.S. War on Terror, Italian Americans. We will talk with a leading authority on the contributions of Italians to the Industrial Revolution in early 1900s America. In the news, a new Scandinavian report says that U.S. women will close the pay gap between the genders sooner than expected. And Harvard dining hall workers win all of their demands from the ultra-elite university. Our feature is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg. And now, it's the news.
This is the news from our side. Bloomberg is the latest national media source to pick up on the fact that brownback government in Topeka is now canceling reports if they don't think the results are going to be what they want. According to Bloomberg, the governor has approval rating about a quarter of the Kansans. A summary of brownback's record shows Kansas' gross state product fell behind the six state region and the region for the third straight year. Private industry wages in Kansas grew at a slower pace last year than they did in the region and in the U.S., as they did during the past 5 years. The number of private business establishments in Kansas trailed both the region and the nation for the last couple years, again continuing a five-year trend. By just about any measure, Kansas' tax experiment has failed to meet the promised performance objectives. Killing the quarterly report won't change this. If anything, if what Ducker said is right, ending the reporting may make things worse. Brownback is now said to be considering tax hikes. He has paid the deserved price for his errors with a 28% approval rating, the lowest of any governor in the U.S. The people of Kansas have paid a bigger price.
A recent report from BillMoyers.com about Missouri's billion-dollar election highlighted some key facts in understanding some of the down-ticket elections happening in less than 2 weeks' time, according to John Light. During presidential election years, like the one political organization, corporations, and unions tend to exert greater influence, as the chart below shows. A larger proportion of down donations causes from individuals as opposed to these groups during an off-year elections. Republicans also tend to dominate state election spending in Missouri legislative races. For instance, Republicans have outraised Democrats by 2-1. In nearby Iowa, a state where both chambers of the state legislatures could swing one way or the other, donors are giving to both parties. Through a sampling of Federal Communication Commission records compiled by the Center for Responsive Politics for BillMoyers.com indicate that Republicans are being more aggressive in their buys of TV ads. One prize that goes to the party that wins state legislative and governmental races is the opportunity to redraw U.S. congressional and state legislative lines in the descendant redistricting that will follow the 2020 census. In most states, the party that controls the state legislature gets to gerrymander district lines in a way that gives it the most seats. Republicans historically have had a better understanding of the potential of state government, where district lines can get drawn and the policies that affect people's lives get made. And made converted effort to win state races. The investment has paid off. The GOP now controls both chambers of the state's legislature in 30 states. And in 23 of those, there is also a Republican governor to sign off on the legislation.
Three cheers for Harvard dining hall workers who won all of their demands from the ultra-wealthy elite university. The Boston Globe reports that Harvard University dining hall workers will return to work Thursday morning's breakfast shift, ending the school's first strike in more than three decades after they voted 583-1 Wednesday to approve a five-year labor contract. Under the terms of the deal, about 750 employees will receive wages of about $35,000 annually and won't have to pay any more health insurance, according to their union. Unite Here, Local 26, satisfied the major demands that led to the three-week work stoppage. About 100 workers celebrated in Harvard Square Wednesday, chanting, "Victory!" and "We love the students," as union officials detailed the agreement. "We've achieved every goal without exception, with no concessions to Harvard," said Union President Brian Lang. He added that the outcome means minimum annual pay of $35,000 is the new standard for food service workers, and we're going to bring them out of poverty. Local 26 represents food service employees at several Boston area schools. Harvard spokeswoman Tina D. Lou Guria said in a statement that the university was pleased the workers' new health care plan would now be consistent with the policy of other union workers on campus. She added that the workers will need to work a full-time job during the year to make $35,000. The agreement addresses wages and health insurance concerns raised by Local 26, while also achieving the affordable wages and health insurance plan design changes sought by the university at a time of constrained resources. "We will have more in this space on the Harvard dining hall strike of 2016 and those famously constrained resources at Harvard later this year."
A recent report by the World Economic Forum highlighted a feature of the Scandinavian model that was sometimes overlooked earlier in this year's presidential campaign. According to Michael Aria at alternet.org, last year the WEF forecasted that it would take roughly 118 years for women to end the pay gap. This year, they pushed the expected arrival date up to 2186. 144 countries were examined for the report, with Iceland, Finland, and Norway ranked at the top for possessing the smallest gaps. The United States ranked 45th. This has gone down since the organization's first report in 2006, where the United States ranked 23rd. Just add closing the pay gap to the list of positive outcomes of Scandinavian social democracy overlooked thanks to the Bernie model. Of course, the United States did finish in the top third, so there are still a good number of countries we are doing better than. What happened to getting gold medals and everything? According to ARIA, the report finds that 54% of working-age women take part in the formal economically globally, but 81% of men do. On average, a woman's unemployment rate is almost 2% higher across the world. Women also worked three times as often as men when it comes to family enterprises, and they're almost twice as likely to work a part-time job. The authors, Richard Sammons and Saida Zahid, write, "The magnitude of gender gaps in countries around the world is the combined result of various socioeconomic, policy, and cultural variables. The index does not seek to set priorities for countries, but rather to provide a comprehensive set of data and a clear method for tracking gaps on critical indicators so that countries may set priorities within their own economic, political, and cultural contexts. Sammons and Zahid conclude also write, "More than a decade of data has revealed that progress is still too slow for realizing the full potential of one half of humanity within our lifetimes." The news tonight was read by Molly Madden, Lon Swearingen, Michael Savoir, and I'm Jen Zeman.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning, a hammer in the evening, all over this land. A hammer out danger, a hammer out a warning, a hammer out love between my brothers and my sisters, all over this land. If I had a bell, I'd ring it in the morning, I'd ring it in the evening, all over this land. I'd ring out danger, I'd ring out a warning, ring out love between my brothers and my sisters, all over this land.
This is the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Lon Swearingen, and we're going to be discussing the book, The Mythology of Work, How Capitalism Persists Despite Itself. We are going to be talking with author Peter Fleming, who is a professor of business and society at the City University, London. Hi, Peter. Do you have anything to add to that?
No, that's fine. That's perfect.
All right. The title of your book, again, is The Mythology of Work. With that in mind, what is neoliberalism and how does it affect the worker?
Neoliberalism is an economic idea that is basically built around the premise that free markets and corporate interests should be the dominant force in society rather than governments or any kind of public organization. And this has affected workers in a particularly interesting way because it exposes individuals in particular to the forces of the economic and the politico-economic trends that have been unleashed on society over the last 20 years. And most of those have been pretty negative on wages, a downward push on wages, and also the dismantling of trade unions in particular.
So that's basically it. The unions are a problem because we don't have them, I guess, strong enough. Is that right?
Well, one of the political kind of rationales of neoliberalism was to actually intentionally dismantle unions because it was argued, according to the economists working in the area, that they kept a artificially high wage. And, of course, if you push this argument to its nth degree, which is why I would argue neoliberal economics is quite a impoverished and rather kind of unrealistic kind of way of seeing society, the wage would be zero. So I think that unions were the real target for many years of Reagan. You've got the air traffic control struggle that occurred that was definitive. And in the UK, the Thatcher attack on the miners' unions, and that was very important for really redefining what work means for the rest of us who come afterwards.
Okay. Well, with that, most of us know what a manager is, but there are there's a term you use called managerism. What does that mean in a corporate setting, and how does it affect the worker?
Managerialism is a term I use to extrapolate from particular people. So in classic kind of political economy, including activism, we kind of look at the manager as a particular person in a position. And what I wanted to argue is that managerialism, which can actually kind of take hold anywhere within the corporate hierarchy and anywhere within the social hierarchy as well. And basically it's an objectification of labour as an individual that is always potentially to be abandoned if that particular personification, if you like, of labour becomes problematic. So it's a very combative way of seeing the worker and labour more generally. And that kind of mentality is associated with human resource management, new public management, and all sorts of settings that have emerged over the last 15 years.
Well, there's an interesting thing here, too, is I see when I was teaching, there are more administrators than when I was going to school. I mean, I had a class or a school that had 4,000 students, half of it was basically junior high, but we only had one principal and a vice principal. Now we've got four or five principals in the same school and less people. So is that something that's in there too?
Oh, definitely. One of the great kind of premises of managerialism is that it proliferates. So as soon as you get a hierarchy in which you have a supervisor or a manager, someone has to manage them. And that can go on ad infinitum. In other words, you just get a big burgeoning of administrative and managerial personnel, sometimes outweighing even the productive workforce within the organization. Universities have been notorious for that. There's a number of reasons for that proliferation. I think that hierarchies proliferate whenever they're present. So if you undermine self-management among the workforce and all of a sudden have an authoritarian structure, that generally tends to amplify the need for more management. And also, as soon as you have a division between those who are producing value and those who are administering value, you're going to have conflict. And whenever there's conflict, you see it again, a proliferation of management as well. So the highly administrative society is usually one that is also quite unequal with the distribution of resources, decision-making opportunities, and so forth. So it's related to power, I think.
Well, there's another thing here. Peter, would you use the tobacco industry as a reference point and elaborate on corporate ideology as a false truth-telling?
Sure. Well, we tend to think of ideology within critical social studies as a way of hiding the truth, as a way of telling lies, basically, or at least giving a very narrow rendition of what's occurring. So for many years, the tobacco industry denied that that tobacco was addictive and that it had carcinogens, et cetera, et cetera. And as soon as the science came out to say, well, there's no way you can actually say that anymore, they had to begin to deal with the truth. And so what I argue what's happened here is that there's a lot of false truth saying. In other words, truths that are designed still to shore up the dominance of this particular corporation. And in that sense, and I use that as a metaphor for what I think is occurring at the moment throughout neoliberal society, this kind of way of using the truth to actually tell lies about how that organization works. So, for example, corporate social responsibility is a very, very good example, where mining companies will talk about the truth of biodiversity and how they're trying to deal with biodiversity, but that really detracts from the broader impact that that organisation and industry has on the natural environment. So there's ways of using the truth to actually give a false, broader false picture of the way in which economy and society work. So the tobacco industry now says, we know that tobacco is, and cigarettes in particular, causes carcinogens, but it's the individual's choice, the sovereign consumer. And that is true, because no one's holding a gun to my head to go down to the shop, to the store, to buy cigarettes. But what that does is that it then undermines the idea that this is a very highly addictive substance, chemical, that is increasingly being geared towards the third world, and there's a whole kind of very, very sordid part of the industry that's developing at the moment around the production of cigarette smokers on a global basis. And I think that's an interesting metaphor for how we should study ideology today, not necessarily looking at for the lies, but looking for the way in which truth is used. George W. Bush, back in the days when he was president, gave a great example of this when he said that he was very proud of the American people to take to the streets to criticize his politics, you know, in the streets regarding the Iraq war. And he was very proud of that because it just showed that he was really behind the democracy of the American people. So as a way of telling the truth, to kind of, in other words, to shore up, I guess, a little bit of deception.
So that's an interesting thing, because they use truth, half-truth, to make it sound like it's all true. And how many people who smoked when they were really young, not realizing what was going to go on, and now that it's the most addictive thing, is nicotine, is what I've heard. And so maybe that's
indeed
the problem.
Yeah, indeed. You could say the same with student debt, you know. If you sign up to a student debt when you're 17, 18 years old going into the university, you know, would a bank allow me to sign up for a mortgage? Probably not. Would I be able to do a whole set of other things in the finance industry? Probably not. But student debt is all about giving the individual the right to choose to gain human capital and to enter into a labour market on a higher level. And that's the truth. But there's a deception that is involved as well.
Right. And now, after all of that, what are some solutions to this problem that we're having with workers not really engaged and things like that? Can we change it at all?
Yes. I think the book is very critical, but it tries to be optimistic in the sense that because the situation arose, it doesn't mean it can't be reversed. So any political regression, which I think is what we've been talking about in the Western world, in the Western economies at the moment, can be turned around. And I think that there's still a lot of hope for the workers' movement. The labour movement is starting to bounce back. You've got the alternative labour movement. You've got people fighting against Uber and Uberization of the workforce. You've got people that are trying to challenge a whole set of regressive employment policies simply because they're so unsustainable. So I think that collectivization is the number one thing that really should be at the forefront of any thoughts about how to deal with it and how to resist and how to reverse some of these regressive trends. And collectivization, not necessarily in the old trade unionist sense, you know, I'm still a big fan of trade unions, but any type of getting together to kind of create a sense of solidarity that really kind of sidesteps the individualization of the workforce. One of the reasons why it's got so bad is that we've been so individualized that when you're a lone individual facing these economic forces, you've got no hope, really, to fight back, unless you're an ultra-rich person. and most of us aren't, of course. So I think that collectivization is very, very important in any way or form.
There is the question of, as I see it, technology is taking away jobs in that, so there'll be less jobs. So there'd be less jobs.
Yes, there is an argument that automation is creating a more and more obsolete work in society. So at the very same time, we're told that work and having a job and sacrificing yourself on the altar of employment is the ultimate good, regardless of all of the negative outcomes it might have. At the very same time, automation is taking away a lot of jobs and a lot of work. And I think there's a good argument behind that, because otherwise we're going to be left in a situation where we have a disconnect between the cultural ideology telling us to work no matter what and the realities of the economy that doesn't have enough jobs to go around. On the other hand, I think that argument has been going on right since the beginning of industrial capitalism. To be honest, you can go right back, and Karl Marx said, you know, automation is all about getting rid of jobs, and that's going to happen really soon. And that argument's been going right. That's quite a consistent argument for the last 200 years. And I'm of the opinion that I think that these trends are important, but capitalism needs labour in order to make itself kind of work. It needs human labour. So I'm actually, when I hear these debates, I'm actually amazed that more jobs haven't been automated, and I think that's an important trend, simply because labour's cheaper, human beings are cheaper to develop in an automatic driving car, for example. Google have been spending millions and millions of US dollars on developing probably hundreds of millions on the self-driving car. It's cheaper just to hire someone on minimum wage, probably outside of the production laws of the economy. And that's really even more scary, that it's cheaper to hire living workers than to automate a job. And that tells us how bad things have got.
Well, that's something that we have to think about, because we have to really go with this, because work seems to be the thing, and you've said that it's a mythology, that it isn't for survival. So how do we get away from thinking work is that? And that's the important thing.
Yeah, I think it's one of the reasons I wrote the book is that I was amazed that we still think of work in rich Western economies. You know, I'm not talking about very poor societies in which work and survival are still very intimately linked, but in very rich, affluent economies, that we still think of work as somehow linked, intimately linked to self-preservation and biological maintenance of my organism. Because, you know, to think about me going into my office writing stupid emails all day for 9 hours, and to see that as akin to hunter and gathering, for example,
right,
it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. There's so many mediations between that act of labor that I'm doing and the money I get, and you know, the tokens I get to buy life and to buy shelter, et cetera, et cetera. So I really wanted to displace that argument that all of the work we do and all of the jobs we do and everything that's justified in the name of it, usually quite regressive politics, is somehow linked to our biological survival. So I really, that was a real kind of argument, and given the title is kind of counterintuitive, that work is a mythology. So the first step is to see that, and I think that's what I've tried to argue in the book. And then the second step is to kind of build alternative identities, alternative social structures that aren't simply revolving and anchored and the notion that we have to work so much, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Well, I appreciate all you've said, and I hope that the audience understands that we need to do something rather than just keep doing what we've been doing. So I do appreciate you, and the book is still, I'm still rereading things in it. It really has given me some sense of what direction we need to go. So I really appreciate it, Peter, for being here. Thanks again.
Well, thank you very much for those kind words, and it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Take care.
Thank you.
The Green Foundation, based in Karnataka, India, started by encouraging local seed saving and has built a network of women farmers who also process their own crops locally, a growing trend in opposition to multinational corporate ag. Hear this inspiring story on Wings, Saturday afternoon at 2:30.
Did you know that you can donate that unwanted car, boat, truck, or motorcycle to KKFI and get a tax deduction for your donation? Find out more by calling 866-628-2277.
The premiere of the last broadcast, an original take of Zombies, Community Radio, Zombies, and More, winner of the Here Now Best of Fest 2016, premieres Wednesday night at 11:30, rebroadcast Thursday night at 7 p.m., if we're lucky.
KKFI would like to take a moment to thank Californos for providing food for our volunteers during our 2016 Fall Pledge Drive and for their continued support over the years in keeping community radio on the air. Thank you, Californos. We couldn't do it without you.
Good evening and welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Tino Scalisi, and that was Bella Ciao, the Song of Resistance, arranged by Giuseppe Torresi. October has been designated Italian American Heritage Month. In this last segment, we will recognize and celebrate the achievements of Italian Americans and their contributions to our national heritage, and particularly to the international struggle for labor and civil rights. I myself am the grandson of a Sicilian national of 1907, who emigrated to the United States from the small coastal town of Capaci, just outside Palermo, Sicily. My great-grandfather, Joe, settled in Detroit after first fighting in World War I for the Americans. He died before I was born, and my grandpa didn't like talking about him, so much of what makes me Sicilian and what I know of the Italian people comes to me as it does to so many of my fellow Americans. It's televisual and cinematic and cartoonishly narrow. Until recently. Joining us on the phone is Dr. Marcella Benciaveni, Associate Professor of History at Hostos Community College of CUNY. Dr. Benciaveni was born and raised in Italy and graduated with honors in 1995 from the University of Calabria. She came to New York to pursue graduate studies in U.S. history and received her master's from NYU before getting her doctorate from the City University of New York, specializing in Italian immigration history under the direction of Philip Canestaro, an expert on Italian fascism and one of the pioneers of Italian-American studies. She's also the author of Italian Immigrant Radical Culture, The Idealism of the Sopracivi in the United States, chronicling the rich revolutionary history of the Italian people. Dr. Benciaveni, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So we spoke at length last night on everything from Italian immigration, Sacco and Vanzetti, yeah, the Wall Street bombing, even a little bit about the mafia in film. And I want to start with something that you said that gave me a little bit of a boost as a Sicilian-American. You said that Italians built New York. What did you mean by that? You gave a very specific example.
Yes. Well, I literally meant what I said. So let me just give you a very quick background for those who are not familiar with Italian immigration. 5 million Italian immigrants eventually came to the United States from the late 19th century to the basically First World War. And most of them, although not all of them, were essentially peasants, so with very little skills and very little education. So in a very similar way to what happened with the Irish before them, they were essentially employed for seasonal jobs and construction jobs. And this is really the time when the United States is really exploding, both in terms of infrastructure and its modern landscape. So a high concentration of Italians were in the Northeast and particularly in cities like New York. And so they were heavily employed in construction sites, digging canals, building bridges, skyscrapers, excavating tunnels. I mean, literally the subway in New York was built by Italian immigrants, and so were many of its landmarks, like the Brooklyn Bridge, skyscrapers. By 1890, the census listed that about 90% of the laborers in New York City Department of Public Works were Italian immigrants. So I literally, meant that we built New York, modern New York.
It's quite literal. They quite literally were the foundation of America, or had built the foundation of America. And so
modern America, right? I mean, it's,
sure.
But they lead to, the infrastructure, definitely, yeah.
And so why do you think that as necessary as they were to building that foundation economically and otherwise, why do you think that they were so feared? Do you think there was something that was intrinsically Italian about them that made them just so hard to accept for the rest of the Americans? Is this something that they learned while in Italy? Or do you think maybe their radicalism, is that something that was born here in America after experiencing the working conditions? Or what do you think?
Right. Well, it is a very complex question, first of all, and it really has to be put in the context of American racial hierarchy and the history of, racism within the United States. So, for example, let me just start by saying that not all Italian immigrants who went to different parts of the world had the same experience. So, for example, Italians migrated in large numbers, even larger than the United States, to Latin America, mm-hmm. and they did not experience any discrimination there.
Hmm.
Interestingly enough, in Latin America, Italians were seen as a bearer of civilizations because within the racial context of Latin America, they were seen as white.
Huh.
Whereas in the United States, Italian immigrants who came for the most part from the southern part of Italy were literally not seen as white. And white, really, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, did not just simply mean the color of your skin, but it really was tied to the question of who is a real American, right?
Sure.
And being an American essentially was constructed under this myth that America was white, Protestant, and of English descent. So if you did not fit all of these three categories, essentially you were perceived as the other, as someone that could not assimilate, as someone that could not make it, because it was perceived essentially as inherently inferior. So in the case of Italian, it was one, their rural background, they came from poor areas of Italy. They were mostly, as they say, the peasants with very little skills, mm-hmm. And education. two, they were seen as a darker skin than, you know, white Americans, and therefore inherently inferior. And when they were listed in Ellis Island, because Ellis Island required that immigrants were actually categorized by race, you know, they didn't use like European or Italian or white. They were listed as Southern European. And in the racial hierarchy of the time, Southern Italian essentially meant just one step above blacks.
Wow.
So that was, you know, clearly a part of the discrimination. And then, as you mentioned, they were also perceived largely as prone to violence. And this was in part because of both the particular history of violence in the South in Italy at the time, which was, again, a result, a response to the failures of Italian unification, but and also the rising labor movement in Italy, which was heavily dominated by anarchists. And so clearly, you know, it was really a fusion, if you want, of all the things that made, you know, people, at least in the perception, the construction of mainstream American, un-American, right? It was like basically the worst of all the things that, you know, you could have. And so for a long time, Italians really suffered because of these perceptions.
And so that, to me, that sounds like if they weren't already radicalized before coming to this country, the experience of being in America and working in the workplaces in America would certainly have radicalized them. Although you do say that there were some of those tendencies, some of those conflicts already in place in Italy before they ever came.
Right. Right.
And so you've spent your life studying Italian American culture and history. And what would you give as the single most important contribution that Italian radicals made to the struggle for democracy? What they called the beautiful idea? What in your mind is the biggest contribution?
Oh my God!
I know there's so many, but
I think there were many, although they really have gone, you know, unrecognized.
Sure.
But if I would say so, on a practical level, I think their tactics of struggles have really made a mark, particularly on the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. I mean, the Italians are the one who introduced tactics like direct action, the idea of sabotage, you know, that you can inflict, you know, economic pain by slowing down work or by refusing to work or by actually damaging the equipment, and also boycotts. But also Italians were known for their solidarity, you know, an injury to one is an injury to all. And in fact, there are many reports in the mainstream newspapers of the time that when there was an insult or, you know, the perception that an Italian, you know, worker was targeted, then all the other Italian co-workers would essentially, you know, revolt. So I think, you know, that eventually, you know, really influenced the one tradition, you know, left a mark on one particular tradition of American labor unions. But if I would have to say really what is the most important thing, the main lesson they can teach us, I really think it's their idealism. You know, I'm always amazed at the extent to which they really believed in their dream. You know, the establishment essentially of, you know, social and economic justice for every man and woman on earth. I mean, they believe that in every sense of, you know, of the word. You know, like they literally meant that, and they lived up to that dream. I mean, they fought in every way they could to make that dream, you know, a reality. They obviously did not succeed, but I think that idealism is still an important aspect of their struggle.
And I think that Absolutely. And the to illustrate your point, I went for a quote from Arturo. Help me with the last name. Giovannitti, is that right?
Giovannitti, yeah, you're saying it very well.
He was a strike leader of the Industrial Workers of the World, the famed Industrial Workers of the World, and was a leader in the Lawrence textile strike in 1912. And he was on trial for his life for either a murder or an attempted murder. And there was something that he said in his closing statements. This is the first time that he ever spoke in the English language, which was the language of his oppressors, literally the language of his jailers. And he said, if you don't mind, he said, "I am 29 years old. I have a woman at home that loves me and that I love. I have a mother and father that are waiting for me. And I have an ideal that is dearer to me than can be expressed or understood. And life has so many allurements. And it is so nice and so bright and so wonderful that I feel the passion of living in my heart." And then, so to me, that really illustrates what, you know, he had an incredible passion for life and for love and for romance and for all of the good things that life had to offer. But then he goes on to say, "But if you let me go, let me tell you that the very first strike that breaks again in this Commonwealth or any other place in America where the work and the help and the intelligence of Arturo Giovannitti will be needed and necessary, there we shall go again regardless of any fear and any threat."
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I'm so glad that you are citing that passage. I mean, you know, this man was an incredibly poet, you know, and actually Lawrence Strike made him, you know, quite famous. And he was an acclaimed radical poet, not just by the Italian, you know, the Italian immigrants, but actually American radicals, you know, really praised him and published his poems. And, you know, he was like literally a celebrity, you know, for a short time after the Lawrence strike. But literally his trial could have been an early Sacconi Vanzetti case. I don't know if we have time. I mean, you know, we can discuss, you know, the Lawrence strike. But yes, you captured, you know, very well, I think, that idealism that I was referring to.
Well, we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left. And you know what? If we can, maybe in the future, you can agree to come back and we can do a part two of this. But let me just get to a few more of these questions. So two things. One, can you very briefly describe the attack from big business and the state power and the effect that it had on our community, on the Italian-American community? Now, we know the bigger stories like Sacco and Vanzetti, but do you have any others?
Well, you know, there are really, again, we can't pinpoint just one thing.
Sure.
But I would argue that there are two major forces that have been successful in dismantling, you know, or diminishing or weakening, you know, this radical movement and the immigrant radical movement in particular, you know, not just the Italians, but immigrants in general.
Sure.
And the two issues are pressure to assimilate,
right,
which essentially meant, as an immigrant, and particularly as an immigrant who has been discriminated for a long time, what are your chances of being accepted unless you're willing to embrace the mainstream values of the country that's hosting you,
right?
And so, you know, again, as I said before, you know, America has been constructed, you know, wrongly so, but has been constructed, essentially, the narrative, you know, the identity has been constructed by the men who have been in power, you know, for the longest time.
Sure.
And so the narrative, again, was that the United States is a country, you know, founded on capitalism, on private property, that it's white, that, you know, it's all middle class, it's like the working class doesn't exist. So everyone eventually is pushed to embrace that, to demonstrate that it's part of that, you know, of that identity.
Sure.
In the case of Italian, you know, as I say, that they've been discriminated for a long time, so the pressure to assimilate were, you know, very high. And then you have something like Sacco and Vanzetti, right, to Italian immigrant were anarchists, who are, you know, arrested mostly on fabricated charges under the Red Scare, you know, there's just national, you know, hysteria about the possibility of a Russian revolution, a communist revolution coming to the United States and destroy basically its foundations. There was clearly no evidence, no true evidence that, you know, a communist revolution would take place in 1919, mm-hmm. but what they're doing is they're capitalizing on these fears to essentially destroy, you know, the labor movement. And so the Italians are part of this larger group of radicals who were targeted by the government essentially as a threat to the country. And you know, anarchists, you know, in particular, were a target because they were not watching, you know, they were not letting
right.
just this go by. They responded to the violence by the state with
sure.
their own violence.
Sure.
And so Sacco and Vanzetti are basically part of this, you know, war. They are the victims of this war in a way. But when they are executed in 1927, you know, despite international and national protest, the message that the Italian Americans are getting is that this is what's going to happen, you know, to anyone who will continue to defy us and will continue to resist. And psychologically, I mean, that's devastating. So a lot of people, we know, I mean, we have data of Italian Americans changing their last names. We know of people who are radicals who tried to, you know, hide that part of their history to their families.
Mm-hmm.
We know people that try to just move on and forget about it. And then, you know, you have the second Red Scare that's even worse, you know, the 1950s, which basically, again, equated radicalism and communism in particular as something that's absolutely un-American. Essentially closing the door to
sure.
to the possibility that you can be simultaneously a radical and a good American.
And this thing that you're talking about, there seems to be some sort of reemergence of that as of late, a rise of this sort of neo-fascism
yes.
in the United States with the nativist America first rhetoric, the anti-immigrant hysteria. Especially since some presidential campaigns have taken off. What message do you think a Giovannitti or a Sacco or a Vanzetti mm-hmm. or a Tresca might send to young workers, young Italian workers or young workers in general, or workers in general, struggling for this beautiful idea in the 21st century? What do you think that they would say?
Well, I think they would first say what they said to their people, which was read, educate yourself, be informed. You know, don't trust, you know, necessarily what is being told, you know, by the government, by, you know, the people who are in power. And, this, you know, that was really, and they did.
And looks like we got disconnected. That's all the time that we have for tonight. Hopefully we'll get Dr. Benchiavenni back on the air some other time. And we want to thank her again for joining us on the Heartland Labor Forum and educating us on this very special working class history and celebrating Italian American Heritage Month with us. And best of luck, and we hope to have her back again soon. And thank you again to all of our listeners out there. Please stay tuned for the next segment.
And we have been unable to reach Mark Grunberg for our segment this evening, so we're going to go ahead and do the calendar. And Molly, what do you got for us?
Okay, this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for October 27th, 2016. Democracy in Action, Moore Squared Public Meeting Addressing Issues of Racism. That's Tuesday, October 25th, 7 p.m., Community Christian Church. What? Oh, today's the 27th. Sorry about that. Theater for Young Americans is producing Click, Clack, Moo, Cows That Type. It's about a strike by cows who know how to negotiate at Union Station. And October 26th through the 29th and November 1st to the 4th, mostly at 10 a.m., except 2 p.m. on October 29th. Trunk or Treat with American Postal Union, October 31st, Halloween, 6 to 8 p.m., 3824 East 16th Street, KCMO. Register, bring your car, give out treats, and or dress up in costume and join in, 816-444-9920. Cross Border Network monthly meeting, Wednesday, November 2nd, 7:30 p.m. Kauffman Foundation, Volker, and Rock Hill, all invited who support international solidarity. First Friday Form for Profit College. Hope for a Price by Jacob Bosch. Friday, November 4th, 11:30 a.m., lunch buffet. 12 p.m. program, Westport Flea Market Bar and Grill, 817 Westport Road, KCMO. Enter the Buffalo Room directly from the rear parking lot. And check out the Heartland Labor Forum schedule at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also listen to today's show. And like us on Facebook, search for the Heartland Labor Forum. Send us your feedback about the show, what you want to hear, what you like or hate. Volunteer for the Heartland Labor Forum by calling us at 816-235-1470.
Okay, thanks, Molly. And tune in next week to Heartland Labor Forum. Our show will be St. Louis Higher Ed Organizing. It's becoming a movement. And I have been your engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.